The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. Glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live inside the Beltway. This time next week, I'll either not be on the air or already back at Studio North. I'm hoping it works. I don't know what my brother-in-law does. He's a Marine. He might have blown it up. I have no idea. But hopefully the cables are connected and I'm able to do it, and I'm going to drive through New Hampshire on the way there. But next week, for the next 6 months, I'm just going to be living south of the Maine border in New Hampshire, gathering up intel, knocking on doors as a roving reporter doing the actual thing, because you can't drop in and actually figure out what's going on. You have to be there. Now, I want to tell you that I hope you had a wonderful Mother's Minute. That's what we call it in our house. Mother's Day is not really a thing. You get Mother's Minute. You get a minute in bed where bad toast and bad eggs are served to you. Then, if you're lucky, your husband, if you've got small children, your husband will take the kids in the morning after church, and they'll go out for, you know, a mother's half hour. And then Mother's Day is over, and you have to cook for the kids later. I know, but I hope you had a great Mother's Minute, really, because we love you mothers. Thank you for listening. Let me begin by telling you, you know, I do show prep on Sunday night for the Monday show, and I came down to the studio this morning, and I read in the New York Times, because immigration is the number one story in the United States. It's basically a wide-open border, and the Biden administration has answered that problem with an app. They don't think a wall works, but they think an app's going to work. And in the New York Times, a news story that's on the landing page is contained this line, quote, "Historically, there is no conclusive evidence that more aggressive enforcement and more punitive sanctions deter mass migration." That's this morning. That is a lie. That is not just wrong, it's a lie. It took me 5 minutes to find Customs and Border Patrol stats. Fiscal year 2020, the last full year under Donald Trump, 458,000 migrant encounters on the southwest border. That's a lot, 500,000. That's after 4 years of aggressive enforcement and more punitive sanctions. Then the changeover year to Biden, fiscal year 2021, that's October, November, December, and half of January of Trump, the rest of the year of the Biden, it went from 458,000 to 1,734,000. 1,734,000 up from Trump's last full year, 458. And then the first full year of Biden is 2,379,000 migrant encounters at the border. So it's almost six times as many in the first full year. And this year it's going to be 4 million, so it's going to be 800%. And the New York Times says, historically, there is no conclusive evidence. I really don't know what that means. What it means is that ideology runs the newspaper. And if it's that wrong on that big of an issue about which that much information is that easily available, then you cannot trust that newspaper on immigration. Like, I remember John Fisher Burns when he was working, I would call him in Iraq. I'd talk to him about Afghanistan. He had lived all. You could trust their foreign correspondents. You cannot trust them on domestic issues. It's a politicized place. The other big story yesterday, and by the way, we'll follow it throughout. You can trust us. The other big story of the weekend is that the presidential campaign is in full swing. And Ron DeSantis was in Iowa. Former President Trump canceled a Des Moines rally. I will play most of the clips from Ron DeSantis, Donald Trump, Chris Sununu, Nikki Haley, Vivek Ramaswamy, Chris Christie, all on the Grand Old Pod. If you're a member of the universe, you can get that. There's not enough time in the whole day to do it, but I think the most important ones from Ron DeSantis and Cedar Rapids is cut number 9.
I think the hope is both Florida and Iowa show strong leadership and a bold agenda can defeat the left in this country. But there's no substitute for victory. We must reject the culture of losing that has infected our party in recent years. The time for excuses is over. We got to demonstrate the courage to lead and the strength to win. If we do that, if we make 2024 election a referendum on Joe Biden and his failures, and if we provide a positive alternative for the future of this country, Republicans will win across the board. If we do not do that, if we get distracted, if we focus the election on the past or on other side issues, then I think the Democrats are going to beat us again. And I think it'll be very difficult to recover from that defeat.
So Ron DeSantis is clearly going to run on Donald Trump lost and lost and lost 2018, 2020, 2022. That's going to be his defining. Now, he hadn't declared yet, but his campaign team is moving into new digs today. They're going to transfer the money to a super PAC. He's got a Florida super PAC, which he can't control, but with $80 million in it, it's going to go to a super PAC, which is run by, I believe, Jeff Rowe will be their senior advisor. Karl Rove summed up, by the way, I want to play this. Donald Trump did not go. They were going to have dueling rallies. Donald Trump canceled his, allegedly because of bad weather. A lot of people thought he might have looked at the crowd and didn't like it. But there was bad weather. There were tornadoes, and you don't hold outdoor rallies in tornadoes. So Ron DeSantis showed up at an Iowa restaurant in Des Moines, about a mile from where the former president was a no-show, and repeated that basic message, cut number 23.
Republicans have lost a lot of elections recently. You've had disaster at our border, crime, an administration that's totally feckless, and people think that the country's best days ahead. But I think Florida and Iowa are sort of hope because we show you can get it done. Requires leadership, requires commitment to principle, requires some courage. But if you're willing to do that and you're willing to deliver results, the people are there. They'll follow because they just want to see a better future. So we've done that in Florida. They've done that in Iowa. You know, we're going to have a chance pretty soon to make sure that's done in every state in this country.
Karl Rove on Fox News Sunday watched the events on Saturday, the DeSantis stump speech and the DeSantis nimbleness of campaign to go over to Des Moines in an unscheduled stop to pick up sort of a second burst and a second media market. There are about four media markets, and I own about half the state, but not the whole state, because I can't get a stick in Des Moines. But Karl Rove says this to Shannon Bream on Fox News Sunday, cut 24.
We're at the beginning of this process. Remember, Hillary Clinton was way ahead in Iowa of a fellow named Barack Obama and was upset on caucus night. I frankly thought it was a good start for DeSantis. He wisely did. In Iowa, they'd like to see up close and personal. They don't want to be part of a 10,000-person crowd or a 5,000. They want to see up close and personal. And he had several events like that. I thought it was good. I was very impressed with his legislative endorsements. The Republican Senate president and the Republican House leader both endorsed him along with 30 of their colleagues. That's a strong strong start. And he's being hosted by the Republican congressman in western Iowa, Randy Defensora. And that's a Republican stronghold when it comes to the caucus.
So Karl Rove is watching with a veteran's eyes. It was a good weekend for DeSantis, not a great weekend for the former president. I'll come back and talk more about that after the former president did launch a contest, which is going to raise a lot of money. But that's after the break. I want to begin my campaign for Angel Tree summer camps. And I told you last week, I gave you a little tip over at HughHewitt.com. There's a banner. It costs $200 to send a kid to camp who otherwise is not going to go if you don't make the contribution. Their mother or their father or both parents are in jail. Every year I do this. Every year this audience comes through. Please support Angel Tree camping because it matters so much. These children listen to this child is an Angel Tree kid, and by that I mean they have been in the past. They're looking forward to going again. Let's play that audio.
It is a great camp for kids to go to. Everybody loves you, cares for you, and it's a great camp. Learn about God. The best part of Angel Tree was, for me, would have to be the activities. I get to play in the gym. You get to go tubing in the lake, wadeboarding, water weenie. What I learned the most about Jesus was that even though that your father has been incarcerated or in jail, you still have a father up in heaven.
Imagine what that does for a kid. Imagine what that camp does. And you can help. $200 sends one kid, $400 says two. For you Steelers fans, if you send 1,000, that will be five kids. Some of you can do that. It's real. It's tangible. You can call 888-206-2764. That's 888-206-2764. Or go over to HughHewitt.com and click on the banner at the very top. And if you've done it before, thank you in advance. You're going to do it again. Try and up the number of kids you send, $200 per kid. If you've never done it, realize you change the trajectory of a life by doing this. This may be the single most impactful contribution you make over the course of a year. And I know it's a lot of money. It's $200. It takes a lot to get a kid to camp. But please prayerfully consider it. Be as generous as you can. Come right back to this Monday, May 15th edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-702-5400. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-702-5400. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-702-5400.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Down to Georgia, he was looking for a soul to steal. He was in a bind because he was way behind and he was willing to make a deal. When he came across this young man sawing on a fiddle and playing it hot, and the devil jumped up on a hickory stump and said, boy, let me tell you what, I guess you didn't know it, but I'm a
welcome back, America,
too.
The devil went down to Georgia and Selena Zito is following him. She's on her way to the peach straight. Good morning, Selena. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good.
I didn't know if you were implying that I was the devil or not.
Well, I'm just saying you're going down to Georgia, so don't pick up the fiddle if there's a suspicious guy around there. Selena, I want to cover two stories with you this morning. I know you're going to talk to Brian Kemp. I have a question request. I would like you to ask him to compare and contrast the governorships of Chris Sununu and Ron DeSantis, because they're both his colleagues and they both get along with Governor Kemp. I just would be interested in what a governor thinks of both of them.
You got it.
Now, New York Times this morning, a direct quote. Historically, there is no conclusive evidence that more aggressive enforcement and more punitive sanctions deter mass migration. It took me 5 minutes to find the stats from Customs and Border, Selena. In 2020 fiscal year, 458,000 migrant encounters at the border. In fiscal year 2021, 1,734,000. In fiscal year 2022, 2,379,000. How does the New York Times say there is no historical evidence that enforcement matters?
Because they want to, not because they're. I mean, I don't know. There used to be fact checkers in newsrooms. I'm not quite sure what happened there.
It's just so absurd.
It's just really so absurd.
And so I just wonder if you talk to people. Who do they believe in? You can't believe the New York Times. You just can't believe NBC. You can't believe people anymore.
Yeah. You know, this has been building for a while. You remember Brad and I wrote about this in our book. It was part of what started to form the conservative populist coalition before Trump. But also you see it on the left as well. You know, there is a reason why voters are on a bit of a bender. And that has a lot to do with the fact that the institutions and the cultural curators that we trusted most of our lives, that our parents trusted, our grandparents trusted, have proven in this past two generations to been full of doo-doo.
That's well put, because we are FCC regulated. But this year, We're going to have 4 million plus people cross the southern border without permission, claim asylum or other status. Secretary Mayorkas never tells the truth. And then the New York Times says there's no evidence that enforcement matters. It went from 500,000 to 4 million in less than 3 years, Selena. Does this come up a lot with people?
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting because it impacts our lives in ways we don't see in headlines. And so I have a friend whose daughter is graduating from West Point. Well, guess who lost her hotel room to go see her daughter graduate? She did, because they were moving the migrants that were coming in to New York, and then New York was shipping them up to the Hudson Valley.
What are they going to do in the Hudson Valley? I mean, if you're not going to West Point, that's not exactly the place to be.
Right, and they're also. I would talk to a police officer last night. There were several buses that came last night. What day is it? To Pittsburgh. Was it last night or the night before? I can't remember.
What do they do with them in Pittsburgh? And by the way, I have great compassion for these people.
Absolutely.
But 4 million is too much. We don't have an infrastructure to deal with 4 million people. That is 8 times the number of people that came in under former President Trump during his last year.
You're right. We're
overwhelmed.
It's a capacity. We don't have the capacity. And we have a problem with housing in our country right now that is impacting people that live here. And you know, people aren't selling their homes. People aren't able to buy homes. And there's not enough housing to support the people that live here. You know, we're not. And we're not thinking about the other impacts that it's having outside of all the obvious ones. There's these small ones.
And that's the number one impact, Selena. Entry-level rentals right there. That's the number one impact when you add 4 million people of working age. They have to lie down somewhere, right? They have to have a roof.
That's absolutely right. And the problem with the pushing back against people who think this is way too much is that if you don't support it, oh, you're racist. Oh, you have no compassion. That has nothing to do with it. It has everything to do with logic.
And you just can't put more marbles in a jar. You just can't. There's no place for the marbles to go to bed. Selena Zito, when are you going to talk to Governor Kemp? Is it today, tomorrow?
Morning.
Okay, remember, compare and contrast. Get an answer from him. No incompletes. Selena Zito will be writing that up at Zito Selena on Twitter or at SelenaZito.com for all of her writings. Thank you. The Inzer Report. Monday, May the 15th, I'm inside the Beltway, as is Jake Sherman, editor-in-chief of Punchbowl News. If you have not yet signed up, remember, punchbowlnews.com gives you a morning newsletter for free, and I read it every morning before the show. And Jake Sherman, I follow on Twitter, and they give you the blow-by-blow of what's going on the Hill. And today, what's going on the Hill is the continuation of Debt Talk. Good morning, Jake. How was your weekend?
I was good, Hugh. How was yours?
Great. I was afraid you got trapped at that Nationals game where they had the rain delay for 4.5 hours and they sent everyone home and they didn't give them the doubleheader the next day. Unprecedented in baseball history. And that would have made you angry.
No, it would have made me angry. I actually thought about going this weekend, but I thought it was a little bit, I would have taken my son. I thought on Mother's Day weekend, I probably shouldn't indulge myself in baseball. I should probably be with my family. So that's where.
No, your wife probably would have liked that if it's your only kid.
You're probably,
but
right.
Yeah, I saw a lot of dads out yesterday with the small ones and no mom around. So Mother's Day is usually best played, as a veteran of 41 years of them, by not getting the children involved. Jake, I want to talk to you about the debt deadline. I already told you I never believed June 1. I note in punchbowlnews.com this morning, it's going to be updated. I heard over the weekend the CBO said June 15th or something like that. Then I heard another report. It might.
CBO concurred with Treasury, said as early as June 1 could slip to 4, 5, or 6, June 4th, 5th, or 6th. But CBO did concur by and large with Treasury's assessment.
Okay, somewhere someone said June 15th, and somewhere someone said it's actually August if they do cash management. So I don't believe it. But Kevin McCarthy, as you report, wants to stick to it. He wants the pressure of a deadline. Who are the 10 people that are doing the negotiating that you mentioned in Punchbowl News this morning?
Oh, we listed them all last week. I will give you some highlights or things that people you might know and the audience might know. Kevin McCarthy's chief of staff, Dan Meyer, who was Newt Gingrich's chief of staff when he was speaker, is one of the people in the room. Dan is actually leaving the speaker's office in a couple of weeks after the deadline. He's been on the Hill for a long time, been in the game for a long time. But interestingly enough, representing the White House is not really a principal. It's Louisa Terrell, who is the legislative affairs director for the White House. It's not Shalonda Young, the OMB secretary director, who would be a lot of people keep saying if you put Shalonda Young in a room with any of these aides, they would get this done quickly. Why? Because Shalonda Young, very respected by Republicans and Democrats, was the staff director on the House Appropriations Committee for many years for Democrats, and now is in the Biden administration. So, listen, on the deadline, Hugh, here's the situation. If they could get first of all, let me start with this. Treasury's going to update it this week. Right now, it's as early as June 1. It would be great for all the negotiators if they could get that into the next week. If they could get till June 15th, they think they could get to July because they get an influx, obviously, of cash from tax payments around June 15th. But everybody is trying to get this done with June 1st to June 7th, let's say, as the deadline.
Now, I repeat, I don't believe it, and I don't believe the negotiators believe it. And I'm looking at the Bipartisan Policy Center, said mid-June. And so that's where I got my number from. It doesn't really matter if they get to an agreement. When they say they're making progress, what are they making progress on, Jake?
So here's the contours of the deal are as follows. Number one, permitting reform, which is probably the biggest policy change that they'll get in this bill. That's for clean gas, natural gas, fossil fuels. That's something that Republicans and Democrats both want to do, is good both for the traditional fossil fuel folks and the clean energy folks. Number two is budget caps. So some sort of deal that places a limit on the growth of discretionary spending over the next at least 2 years. I think they'll have to get a little bit more than that. Number three, what they hope to get, and I think they're going to get this, is rescinding some of this unspent COVID money. As we've discussed many times, you and I, Hugh, the government has spent a tremendous amount of money on COVID relief over the last 3 or 4 years. There's about $60 billion by Republicans' estimate that is still out there. They'll either rescind it or reprogram it or do something to change how that looks. And number four, I don't know that this is going to happen. This is the biggest stretch, is work requirements for social safety net programs. Now, there are some in the Republican Party who don't want to do this because for a lot of reasons, mostly political reasons. But Joe Biden this weekend gave new urgency or gave new hope, new life to some sort of work requirements for social safety net, saying he would be interested in taking a look at where Republicans are. So that's the broad contours of the plan.
You know, I would be I do somersaults over a 6-year cap on domestic non-defense discretionary spending at 2022 levels. I think that would be a huge win for the country, but it can't have defense in it. I mean, it really cannot have any limit in defense because China's ahead and getting further ahead. Is that off the table? Any kind of cap on discretionary defense spending, Jake Sherman?
I think that I don't know the answer to that, but by the way, it's not going to cap. It's not going to cap for 6 years at the 2022 level. What they're trying to do, what Republicans want, is some sort of cap with a percentage growth lock-in, meaning so the budget can only grow by, let's say, 1% a year for 6 years. Now, remember, we've done this before, and Congress has undone those after the deal is passed. So I'm thinking about the Budget Control Act, which was undone by a lot of by members of Congress, you know, several years after it was passed. So, yes, this is – listen, it would be a good deal in divided government. It would be any of this would be a good deal for Republicans, especially with Democrats controlling the White House and the Senate. Now, whether McCarthy could get away with it, Hugh, we'll have to see.
Well, it will not get through a Congress, either House, if it caps defense spending. It just won't. There aren't enough moderates who won't. But if they do the 1% for 5 years or 6 years, that is healthy. That's a big first step. And then I would imagine they don't need either the far left, the AOC, the squad, or the far right, the Freedom Caucus, They would get Democrats to vote for it in the House, right?
Yeah, any deal like this will be endorsed by all the leaders if they get to a deal, and therefore would get, you know, the traditional coalition of leadership-aligned lawmakers in both parties.
Now, so we finally have the president engaged, at least his team engaged. The Neera Tanden promotion, I thought, was significant. She actually also knows her way around the budget. Is she involved at all?
No, she's not. Right now, it's Louisa Terrell, who's, as I mentioned, the legislative affairs director, one person from the National Economic Council, and one person from OMB. But listen, what they're trying to do, Hugh, is they're trying to give the principals a menu of options. The big four, that's Schumer, McConnell, McCarthy, and Jeffries, are going to meet with the president tomorrow before Biden heads to Japan for the G7, Japan and Australia, I believe. And that's, you know, Biden had talked about not going in order to get this deal. I don't think that's necessary. The president, I don't mean this in a pejorative way, but typically in situations like this, presidents are figureheads. They're not getting involved in the negotiations. By the way, neither is Kevin McCarthy. The principals are just designating their aides to get this done and giving them their proxy.
Yeah, the aides get close, and then you do the deal with the principals.
Exactly.
Jake, I want to bet lunch. Or maybe an invitation to the Punch Bowl Christmas party, which I've never gone to, on the June 1 day. Because it's not June 1. And you've been steady in saying, yeah, it is June 1. If it's after June 21st, all right, I'll give you the first 3 weeks.
Let me clarify what I mean. What I mean is if Treasury says it's June 1, it's June 1 until Treasury says it's not June 1, is my point. And by the way, they change. These dates change. So we are June 1 until probably at some point this week when they kick it to June 8.
I'm going to say I'll give you up to June 21. You want the under or the official date? It's going to be moved at least to June 21 because we're not going to wrap this up. He's going to go to the G7. They're going to find the money. What a surprise. And they'll get it all done for when the president returns. That's what I think.
I think that they get it to June. I'll take the under. Yeah.
Okay, so that's lunch or an invitation to the Punch Bowl Christmas party to which I've never been invited. I'm just saying that, Jake.
My honor, Hugh.
Yeah, I'm just saying. It's been how long you guys been in existence now?
About 2.5 years.
All right, so that would mean like 100 appearances on the Hugh Hewitt Show, right?
Probably something like that, yeah.
So 100 appearances. It's sort of like my airline miles for Sonny Bunch. I just want some return on my investment. Jake, I hope you had a wonderful Mother's Day. Welcome back, America. Josh Kroshauer is with Jewish Insider. He is our man inside the Beltway, even when I leave to go up to New Hampshire and Maine. Josh, I'm leaving next week, and I'm going to spend 4 or 5 months in the North because I really think the biggest story in the world is New Hampshire primary. And the friends and allies of Hugh, the FAOHs, or the SSPH, the Senate and People of the Universe, believe that campaigning matters. What do you think? Are you jaded against actual in-the-flesh campaigning now?
So number one, have a great time in New England in the summer, which is one of the best places to be. You should go to Fenway Park while you're up there.
If the Guardians are in town, Josh. Only if the Guardians are in town.
Yes, Hugh. Campaigning matters. That's why. I mean, it's easy to be in the moment. We talk about polls. We talk about developments on the campaign trail every week. But the reality is this is a long slog, and retail politics matters. I think even more importantly, Hugh, in primary politics, results in Iowa and New Hampshire matter a whole lot and can change the whole dynamic of the nominating process. And if the DeSantis team is smart, and I do think they are, they know that Iowa and New Hampshire, but Iowa especially this weekend, is sort of the key to it all, to have another moment where DeSantis shows up a whole lot in the first in the nation caucuses, does a lot of retail campaigning, shows his face, shows why he did so well in his reelection in Florida, and slowly eat into the Trump advantage. And if he can, look, Iowa is a state with a lot of evangelical voters. They love retail politics. If DeSantis can do what he did over the weekend and continue to have good reviews week after week after week, you know, a win in Iowa could change the whole dynamic in this nominating process.
Is it too much to say if you're not in Iowa or New Hampshire over the weekend, you're losing ground? Because I really do believe that this year. If you're not there, either of those states, over a weekend, you're losing ground.
Yeah, I mean, certainly if you're not, I mean, Trump should be there too, but like it's a little bit better to be the front runner. But if you're Ron DeSantis, you need to be camping out in Iowa and New Hampshire, maybe a little bit in South Carolina too, but certainly Iowa and New Hampshire. for the next 6 months once he announces that campaign. Because, look, the early states give you a momentum of your own. We know this from experience. Now, I know Iowa, Ted Cruz won Iowa in 2016, and Trump still won the Republican nomination. But if DeSantis can, you know, surprise everyone in Iowa, parlay that into New Hampshire, and then all of a sudden the race would look a whole lot different.
Or if anybody else takes the silver other than Ron DeSantis in Iowa and Trump, gold and silver expected to go to Trump and DeSantis. If anybody else breaks onto the medal, that could matter a lot in New Hampshire. But I believe those votes have got to be earned in person. Every caucus goer and every New Hampshire primary voter expects to see the candidates, or at least see that they're in town, Josh. True or false?
Oh, absolutely. And that's what makes the primary process, at least for the Republicans now, so special. I mean, Democrats are sort of throughout the retail politics playbook this year, and I think they may regret it in the future, because you do have a vetting. You do have this unique process where, you know, in Iowa, New Hampshire, voters are well attuned to politics. They actually spend time doing the work, doing the research, and they expect candidates to know their stuff, to know policy, to know about the issues that are affecting these states. And it gives you a vetting that you can't find anywhere else, and certainly you can't find when you're spending millions and millions of dollars on TV ads in much bigger states.
So let me play for you Karl Rove on Fox News Sunday yesterday, summing up the DeSantis was there and Trump wasn't. DeSantis followed through. Trump canceled because the outdoor rally was threatened by tornadoes. Cut 24.
We're at the beginning of this process. Remember, Hillary Clinton was way ahead in Iowa of a fellow named Barack Obama and was upset on caucus night. I frankly thought it was a good start for DeSantis. He wisely did. In Iowa, they'd like to see up close and personal. They don't want to be part of a 10,000-person crowd or a 5,000. They want to see up close and personal, and he had several events like that. I thought it was good. I was very impressed with his legislative endorsements. The Republican Senate president and the Republican House leader both endorsed him along with 30 of their colleagues. That's a strong strong start, and he's being hosted by the Republican congressman in western Iowa, Randy Defensa, and that's a Republican stronghold when it comes to the caucus.
So, Josh Krosshauer, endorsements normally don't matter much. I think legislative endorsements in the first two states do. What say you?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think Carl is right. It's not so much the number, but it's the quality. You have, I think, the number two leaders in both the state House and the state Senate in getting on board the DeSantis bandwagon. So those are pretty big endorsements in the early state, like Iowa. You also had, you know, no one, they didn't endorse, but the governor of the state, Senator Ernst, not just Fenstra, but also Congresswoman Marionette Miller Meeks, also there at the DeSantis event. So, you know, a good show of support for DeSantis in Iowa. I also think, by the way, that as much as DeSantis was panned for signing the 6-week abortion ban in the state of Florida, I mean, that is a play for the primaries. That's a play for the Iowa caucuses, and having a very firm socially conservative position that can really allow DeSantis to separate himself from Trump in that caucus, where they typically reward the candidates who are more pro-life and more.
You know, Josh, thank you for bringing that up. I've heard a lot of legacy media slagging DeSantis for that. They just don't understand the Republican Party. They just don't, and they don't want to. Maybe their newsrooms don't have any pro-life people in it, but the pro-life voter cares about that more than anything else. And I mean, that's year after year, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously maybe general election, it could be a disadvantage, but certainly for the primaries at the time when he needs to get momentum against Trump, it's an obvious thing.
Josh Krosshauer on Twitter, also with Axios and Jewish Insider. Thank you, Josh. Come back, Josh Krosshauer. Don't go anywhere, America. I'll be right back. Hour number three, Ambassador Robert O'Brien. Glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hear you at live inside the Beltway. Foreign Affairs is the preeminent magazine of the blob. The blob is the National Security Foreign Affairs Establishment, the Council on Foreign Relations, the 1,000 think tanks, everybody who's ever been anyone in national security. And it still is the journal of record. Foreign Affairs is the journal of record for where American foreign policy is going, the consensus position. So I was thrilled when the new issue came out last week, and it headlines an article co-authored by Ambassador Robert O'Brien and historian Arthur Herman on the need for Congress to help the president counter China. And I tracked down Ambassador O'Brien, the last national security advisor and the most successful national security advisor under President Trump, and he's in Tokyo this morning. Good morning, Robert. It is 9 p.m. there. Thank you for staying up late with me.
Good morning. Greetings from Tokyo.
So the Foreign Affairs magazine is the heart, beating heart of the establishment. I am amazed that they let you and Arthur write for it.
Well, what we're seeing, and we're seeing this in Tokyo at the Munich Security Conference, is that there's a new consensus developing. And our allies know, the establishment knows, that we're in a race for our life against China. With the advent of AI, quantum computing, the tech race that we're in, our way of life is on the line right now. And we either win and maintain a free country, a free world, or we lose, and it's going to be a dystopian future. And what's amazing to me is not just that the establishment in Washington printed our article. It's the fact that here the Japanese, the Germans, the French, the English, the Australians for sure, are coming to the same consensus.
So when Richard Nixon published his article on China in 1967, it was the first omen that a change was coming. I think when you and Secretary Pompeo and Christopher Wray and Bill Barr and Vice President Pence did your cycle of speeches in the last year of the Trump presidency on China, that was a sign that the weather had changed. However, this morning in the Post, David Ignatius has a column on your successor as National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, being in Vienna for 2 days and being very pleased with the direction of Chinese-American relations. That's a head fake, Robert. Well, I mean, that's just a giant head fake. Are we going to go backwards now that we move forwards?
Look, I hope not. And Jake's been one of the more hawkish folks in the Biden administration on China. So we'll see. I think what's happening to China understands is that the free world is starting to band together against them. And they're getting nervous when you have Israel, Japan, Taiwan, Korea, the U.S., U.K., Netherlands getting together to deny China the tools it needs for the semiconductor industry. Building legacy plants for semiconductors, not just the advanced plants. So we're bringing the supply chain back to the free world. They're seeing that big tech, the backlash against big tech is, I think, hit a crest, and it's falling away. So I think they were hoping that they'd use the U.S. Congress to get rid of Google and Apple and other big tech companies.
The Foreign Affairs article list a bunch of things you want Congress to do. And I don't want to run out of time without giving a summary because it's behind a paywall. And some people subscribe to Foreign Affairs because it is the journal of record for the national security blob establishment. Call it what you will. It matters. What are the key things that you and Arthur Herman want the Congress to do?
Well, we've got to ban TikTok immediately. I was on a panel this morning here in Tokyo with a senator from Australia, James Patterson, young guy. He's a social media guru. He put out a report through his committee on TikTok, and it's horrifying. So we've got to ban TikTok. We've got to stop the Chinese from buying military agricultural land around our military bases. We've got to shut down the Confucius Institutes at all our colleges and universities where they're spying on Chinese expats and stealing research from our universities. There shouldn't be one Confucius Institute or some fake new name Confucius Institute at any college in America. And if the college wants a Confucius Institute, they want Chinese money, we got to cut them off with federal money. So those are just a couple examples here of things that are totally within our control that we can do right now to protect against the communist Chinese.
Now, you have followed the Belt and Road Initiative very closely, as is obvious from the Foreign Affairs article. Does the Congress need to support the executive in countering that kind of, whether it's a port in Namibia, a port in Cambodia, a base in Djibouti? The CCP is everywhere with CCP money. Does the United States have to follow them and outbid them everywhere?
You know, we don't have to outbid them, but what we can do is offer a better alternative, a less corrupt version of the foreign aid that they're getting from China, a version where half the foreign aid doesn't go to dictators' bank accounts in Switzerland, and the other half goes to Chinese companies that bring Chinese workers in. So that's why every time I take a foreign trip to one of these developing countries, I always took Kim Reed from OPIC or Adam Bowler from DFC with me to show that the U.S. could finance projects, but we could do it in a transparent way and a way that benefited the people of that country, whether it's Kenya or Namibia or Brazil, and that they could have trusted 5G, they could have trusted factories, trusted port systems, and not be hostage to the Chinese.
Now, Robert, you are loved in Japan because you forged a pretty good relationship with their old national security advisor, with the deceased prime minister, with their ruling party. Now this security conference is a new development. It's bigger than Montreal. It's bigger than Reagan. It's bigger than Munich. What are they talking about in the hallways of Japan when they talk about China?
Look, people are worried. The biggest thing they're worried about is scale. The Chinese are so big and they're so committed to winning in AI and quantum and robotics that if they get ahead of us, and especially with things like quantum and AI, we could have a very dystopian future. They'll control the world. And a Chinese world is not a pleasant world. It's a world where Uyghurs go to concentration camps, where Democrats in Hong Kong are put out of business and put in jail. It's a world where India and Taiwan and ASEAN countries in the South China Sea are threatened with military action if they don't kowtow and toe the Chinese line. Very different world than the world we're living in today. And everyone knows it. The French know it. The Germans know it. Of course, all the ASEAN nations know it.
Well, it used to be that Japan's ruling party didn't really want a confrontation with China, and they had strained relations with South Korea. Is the alliance actually taking shape at this conference?
So we're seeing it. The South Koreans and the South Korean president and the Japanese prime minister get together 2 weeks ago and talk about how they can work together. There's a lot of interest in the Quad, the diplomatic arrangement between Australia, India, the U.S., and Japan, and other countries went in. I mean, I kind of call it the cool kids at the lunch table syndrome, that now, you know, the ROK and Taiwan and other countries want to get in on the Quad. The French have sent a lot of resources out to the South Pacific, to their islands. So I think that, like, there's an understanding that China is going to be very aggressive. And the best way to avoid a war with China, which everyone's worried about, is through deterrence. It's through peace, through strength. It's not through appeasement. I think the old days of appeasing China, people realize that just created a more aggressive and a more assertive China. It's now time for the free world to deter China.
Now, has Japan banned TikTok? I'm not sure they have the big tech replacement that our big tech can provide for social media, but do they have a replacement for TikTok?
You know, I don't know if Japan has a great replacement, but I'll tell you one thing they have is they've banned Huawei, and they've been just terrific on 5G. So you don't have Huawei in Japan. You've got Japanese 5G and eventually we'll have Japanese 6G. And some of those companies are going to do business in the U.S., so... you know, TikTok is a problem everywhere. The Indians have banned it, but it's a whole combination of TikTok and Huawei and WeChat and Chinese intellectual property theft and quantum computing advances being made in Japan and the U.S. It's a whole package that the Chinese are relentless, and we've got to confront them on all fronts.
It would not be a Robert O'Brien interview if I didn't ask you about the Japanese Navy. China has built the biggest navy in the least amount of time in the history of humankind. What is Japan doing on the water and under the water to counter that fleet?
Well, I'm going to talk about this in a speech tomorrow in Tokyo. One of the things is the Japanese have probably the best diesel electric sub in the world. They run forever. They're kind of like the Honda that I drove in college, and all you have to do is change the oil. They last for years. But the Japanese trade in their submarines for new ones every couple of years. They need to extend the life of their submarines and go from a fleet of 22 submarines to 28, 29 submarines. That'll be a real deterrent. And if a war broke out, it would be a huge advantage for the West in a conflict with China. So, look, Japan is doing some great things. They've increased defense spending to the magic 2% of the GDP number. They've converted their helicopter aircraft carriers to real aircraft carriers so the F-35 can fly off them. F-35B. So Japan's doing a lot, but going back to your point, Hugh, with everything Japan has done in the last 5 years, China has built more ships than the entire Japanese Navy since 2016.
It's amazing. Ambassador Robert O'Brien, thank you for joining me. Follow him on Twitter, Robert C. O'Brien. Go and read his Foreign Affairs magazine piece, co-authored with Arthur Herman, called The President Can't Counter China on His Own. Every member of the national security community needs to read and remember this. Have a great time and go to bed, Ambassador. Thank you for staying up late in Tokyo. I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.